so it's just so we have a backup.
Yeah, But perhaps in the last couple of days, I've been about double the load drive every time they want to rain, but I put the ditch in and then we get the fill.
Okay. I would normally be racing it from the seat. Oh, yeah. What the
Good afternoon. I'll call the meeting of the Environmental Quality Board to order, and maybe just a little bit of housekeeping. All of these mics are live all the time, and I haven't quite figured out how to not make them live yet. So is there any help available to...
I have a pocket knife.
Yes. Is that working?
Yeah.
Oh, it would be the mute button, right. Very good. Thank you. Thank you.
Technology.
Yes, it's technology. What were you going to do without it?
How are you going to turn it on?
Good idea. How's that? How about that?
Now you're on.
All right. All right. Again, thank you, members of the board, for taking the time to be here, and thank you to our hosts, the City of Duluth, for a warm welcome. We had a wonderful tour of the steam facility, the steam plant this morning, learned lots about the operation and opportunities that they have to look at a bright future in terms of the ability to use different process fuels, and we're excited to be able to see that opportunity in the first person. I think what I'd like to do is go through the members of the Environmental Quality Board and please ask them to give an introduction from themselves. I'm Dave Fredrickson. I serve as the chair of the board appointed by the governor, but I also serve as the commissioner of agriculture and would be on the environmental quality board regardless. But I somebody had to draw the short straw, and I guess it was me. And so my background is that of a former dirt farmer out in the western part of Minnesota, and evolved to other areas of public service, and I flunked retirement and came back to work, and I've continued to serve as Commissioner of Agriculture for the past 3.5 years. So, Sandy, maybe we'll start with you and ask you to give a little background and introduce yourself, please.
Thank you. I'm Sandy Rummel. I'm chair of the Environment. Mm-hmm. So there's another button besides the new button, which is unmute. Sandy Brummel, Metropolitan Council. I sit on the Environmental Services and chair of that committee. In my past life, I was in the Senate and served on environmental committees in the Senate. I sit on this illustrious board as a substitute for chair lady.
I'm Julie Gary.
John Sachs, I'm a citizen member from the Twin Cities.
I'm Brian Epstead. I'm the chairman of the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and I'm also an Aiken County Commissioner, so I hail from only about 60 miles west of here.
And I'm Tom Lamer. I'm a commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources for the last 3.5 years, appointed by Governor Mark Dayton. Prior to that, I worked for the DNR as a wildlife biologist for 17 years. I worked in Epson Limited for 5 years, and I worked for the Nature Conservancy for the last 7 years before I took this job.
Will Seifer, Executive Director of Environmental Quality Board.
My name is John Langstein. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Tom, my My bio is career bureaucrat, 25 years as a hydrologist at the DNR, 6 years at the Department of Health, and about 3 at the Pollution Control Agency.
I'm Kate Knuth, a citizen member of the board from the Twin Cities. I'm doing a little bio. I worked at the University of Minnesota's Institute of the Environment, previously served in the State House from the North Suburban District.
I'm Pat Bellinger, Commissioner of Health. I'm a physician and have worked in public health for 30-some years. And just for today, I'm wearing my climate change tie, so we got the greenhouse gases, the temperature chart, and the little polar bear on the ice floor.
It's been worse. I've seen E. coli neckties around his neck.
My name is Eric Tomlinson. I'm a citizen board member from the Twin Cities. For a little bio, I'm a citizen member with water resources expertise that citizen members are quite attended. I'm a hydrogeologist at the Commission.
I'm Kristen Mady Tomlinson. I'm a citizen member from Southeast Minnesota, and my background as a citizen is in energy.
And Bill Grant, I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, sitting in today for Mike Rothman, and I direct the Energy Division at the Department.
And I'm Yvonne Kretner-Sola. I'm the Lieutenant Governor here in the state of Minnesota, and I served on in the state Senate for 9 years prior to that, representing Duluth. And prior to that, I was 12 years on the Duluth City Council, sitting in this very room. And while I was in the Senate, I chaired the Energy Committee.
So it's deja vu all over for you, sitting here. Well, again, thank you all, and thank you all, particularly the citizen members who took time from their busy schedules to be here today. So thank you very much for that. I'm going to ask Will to move directly to the Executive Director's report, and then we will move then to Lieutenant Governor Sola's presentation.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to express our thanks to the Mayor's Office and the City for accommodating our meeting here today. Climate change is a big priority on the board this year. We've engaged Minnesotans in these conversations statewide. As you can see from the report in front of you today, it's a bit special for me personally. I have Lieutenant Governor here today, as I had the good fortune of being able to work for her when she served this community at the Minnesota Senate, chaired the Energy Committee, and worked hard to find consensus and collaboration around these issues, and really set the foundation for why we're here today and what we're working on. So thank you for your great service. I want to take a quick minute to recognize our departing Kate France, who's been a foundation for the staff work here at the board over the last couple of years.
Raise your hand.
Hi. Yeah. just a quick note to members of the board. The website, as you know, and we've been working on a migration project. Our website is now, we have a new redesigned website that is available now. You should peruse it and offer your thoughts and suggestions. We'll work on updating content and making some changes throughout the rest of the year, so we welcome your feedback. As I mentioned here earlier, we're here today to roll out this report that you have in front of us. It's the purpose is to start a conversation with Minnesotans about how climate change is impacting the way we work and live and play here in Minnesota. This is an effort that's been underway for months, and is built on the hard work from the experts that are work for in your agencies and your respective agencies. So I just want to thank you for your contributions to this report, and it looks at climate change from a whole range of perspectives, all that are represented here on the board. So I think it's a great product, and thank you again for supporting this effort. In addition to this report, the board is also working across agencies to evaluate policies that could reduce emissions in agriculture, forestry, waste management, transportation, land use, energy supply, and demand-side energy management. This project, referred to as Climate Solutions and Economic Opportunities, CEO, builds off of the 2008 Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group work and should be concluded by the end of this year, early 2015. And so a couple real quick brief updates before we move on to the next agenda item. The next SOCA SAM rulemaking advisory panel is scheduled for Thursday, August 28th. As I indicated at our last meeting, we'll be discussing this rule at our September board meeting and inviting public comments. And also, the governor's community and economic development summit occurred on July 17th. It was tremendous success with broad participation. Thank you to our agency leaders in commerce and DEED and all partners who participated. The final report from Collaborative Economics represents the state's most comprehensive effort to quantify the direct employment and wages of clean energy businesses. And this will also be presented to the board by next week. So, thank you.
Thank you, Will. And I've done it again. I've forgotten to do the adoption of the consent agenda. So let's just hop back to item number one. Is there a motion to approve the proposed agenda for the August 20th board meeting and a motion at the same time to approve the July meeting minutes, which are enclosed in your packet?
Chair, I had a question on the minutes, and I read them, but I forgot my packet at home. But I think, I'm not sure if my name was included as in the July meeting, so I just wanted to add that in, or at least make sure.
On the July, on the Wednesday, July 16th minutes? Okay.
If it's not show,
we shall
present,
do that.
It does not show you absent either. Okay.
Doesn't show you present, doesn't show you absent, so we'll make sure it's included. So, as amended.
I'll move approval, Mr. Chair.
As amended.
As amended.
All right. Is there a second?
Second.
There is a second. Is there further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. At this point, we're really pleased and proud that Lieutenant Governor Prentner Solon has joined us today. As you have indicated, Yvonne, that your long service to the community of Duluth and certainly to the residents of the state of Minnesota are duly noted and much appreciated. I have known and worked with Yvonne Prentner Solon, Lieutenant Governor, Senator, for a long, long time, and I'm telling you that we'll miss your service as Lieutenant Governor here in Minnesota. You've done an outstanding job, and I know I speak for the entire board when I say that. And we're pleased to be here in your city today, the city of Duluth, and pleased to have you as a presenter here today. And thank you for your work, particularly on issues of energy, climate change, renewable energy. Without the efforts that you made as a state senator, we wouldn't be a leader in the industry today and in these areas. So with that, Yvonne, please.
Thank you, Commissioner Fredrickson. And it has been a pleasure to work with you and all of the commissioners and all of the staff in the state government. I continue to be amazed at the wealth of information, the high quality of staff that we have in public service. And it has been just a thrill for me to be able to have this time to spend with people that I know really care about the work they do and do their best for the state of Minnesota. You all are among them, so thank you very much. And I want to welcome everybody to Duluth. It's always a pleasure to showcase the city of Duluth and to have people here experiencing the wonder of our Great Lake and the city of Duluth. We'd love to have you here. And I want to thank you for being here for this important meeting. And as you know, we are joined here by several other commissioners who have also introduced themselves now, and our executive director, Will Seifert, who mentioned that we've worked together for a long time on energy issues. And he was the perfect person to become the executive director of EQB. So, Minnesota's climate is changing, and we all are noticing it. A new national climate assessment came out this spring with projections that climate change will continue to exacerbate droughts and extreme rain events that damage our crops and endanger our infrastructure, and heat waves that endanger our health. As temperatures...
I accidentally hit a button.
Mayor, you know you're always upstage.
All right.
No.
For those of you that don't know it, we've been joined by the mayor of Duluth, Mayor Ness. I'm sorry, we just noticed you walked in. Yes.
Something. I know Jeff Cox is over here showing
him. Yeah,
we're
here.
Yeah, thanks.
I guess we lost our presenter.
Nuclear option.
Sorry, everyone. Think you can project?
Are you on? No.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. I can do my best. Can you hear me?
Sure.
Okay. I'll speak loudly. So as I was saying, that temperatures have increased and they have created a number of changes. The good news is that they have a lot of solutions, and those solutions offer opportunities. Minnesota has no fossil fuels of its own. Today, we export over $13 billion a year for fossil fuels we import from other states and other countries. But we do have ample sun, wind, biomass, and we have innovative scientists and entrepreneurs here in Minnesota. One of the bills that I'm most proud of championing during my career as a public servant is the Next Generation Energy Act of 2007. And this was a bipartisan effort where we came together to set goals for renewable energy, energy efficiency, greenhouse gas emission reductions, and finally, a call for a state climate plan. Most of this bill has been wildly successful. We now generate over 20% of our electricity from renewable sources. We have cut our utility bills by being more efficient with how we use our energy, and all of this has been done in ways that keeps our electricity rates competitive. In 2007, we began work on a climate plan, but we never finalized it. So we are not on track to reduce our emissions by 80% in 2050, or even to the 2015 benchmark of 15%. While emissions have gone down in the electric and transportation sectors, they continue to increase or stay the same in other sectors. The governor's executive order for the reemergence of a strong environmental quality board was driven in part by our need to develop a climate plan. The report the board is releasing today is the first step. It is accessible and clear, a way to reach out to all Minnesotans. It makes clear that climate change puts our way of life at risk, but it does more than outline the risks. It asks us all to raise awareness. There was a postcard in the back of this book asking us to start climate conversations with our friends and neighbors, our fellow Minnesotans. I'm starting mine, and I cannot wait to see how you will start yours also. That climate plan is not forgotten. The EQB is now examining possible solutions that can help us reach our goal of reducing emissions. This work is critical to mitigating the impact of climate change. Equally important is ensuring that the process is transparent and that it's open to all points of view. Implementing emission reduction strategies requires that we incorporate the views of both the environmental community and the business community. And here in northern Minnesota, we have long understood that job creation and protecting the environment aren't mutually exclusive. In fact, they go hand in hand. And that's why the public and the industries will have a chance to get involved and make comments in a series of stakeholder meetings throughout the fall and early winter. So we got a lot done in 2007, but now we need to finish that job. So thank you, and I wish you all luck, and I'm eager to see the progress that's being made.
Thank you very much, Lieutenant Governor. Will you stand for any questions?
Certainly I will. I'd be glad to take questions, but I just need to say that I have to be on another board meeting by telephone at 2 o'clock, and I have to be in the cities by 4:30. So
well, we'll save our questions till later.
I will have to leave in about 15 minutes. It's not that I'm bored with the meeting. I just have to move on.
We understand. Questions for Lieutenant Governor? Guess not.
Okay.
So thank you. Yeah. Oh, okay.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank you, Lieutenant Governor, Partner Solon, for your service. And as a freshman legislator, and when the Next Generation Energy Act passed, I got to see firsthand the sort of impact of leadership over many years of many other legislators. And I'm curious, with this report, and I think it's a beautiful report, it's easy to understand, it's easy to, and that's exactly what we want, it's easy to use. What are some of the ways that you're looking forward to in terms of using this report looking forward? I mean, we have some ideas, but I'd love to hear some of yours as well.
First of all, I'd like to acknowledge that Kate Knoop and Sandy Rummel, and I saw Ellen Anderson in the audience also, were all people that were instrumental in that legislation that passed in 2007. In fact, Ellen was the chair, was the author, I think Kate was too, of the renewable energy legislation.
Co-author.
Okay. I think we all are co-authors, but Ellen was the chair in the Senate of the Renewable Energy Standard. So, and Kate, I have to say, I haven't read the book. I haven't read the plan. It's the EQB's plan. I know that in concept what the plans are, but I think that probably Bill or one of the commissioners will have to give you more detailed information about it. I just know that I've been very concerned for a long time that we haven't been meeting these carbon reduction goals, and I am excited that we are now taking it seriously and planning moving forward.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much. Good luck with your next meeting. I know it's a big one for you this afternoon, and so safe travels back to the Twin Cities. And again, thank you for being here and welcoming us so warmly to Duluth.
Thank you.
Mayor Ness. thank you for sharing your seat with me. We all have made introductions around the table. I serve as chair of the Environmental Quality Board. I'm Dave Fredrickson. And I serve as Commissioner of Agriculture. And again, thank you for allowing us to use your chamber and me to allow me to sit in your spot here. And notice that I have not screwed up anything yet.
I took care of that already.
I know that you are on a tight schedule also. But thank you so much for, again, being here and the leadership that you've shown. I know we're going to talk a little bit about Duluth and its recovery from the Great Flood. And, of course, being the mayor, you get opportunities to see the highs and deal with the lows. And certainly that was a low time for the city of Duluth. But congratulations on bouncing back, as you have. We looked at the plant this morning, steam plant, and we're so impressed with the work that they do there and the service that you provide to the city. And so with that, thank you, and
thank
floor
you.
Is yours.
Yes, thank you very much.
I'm sorry we don't have a microphone for you.
Well, no,
you're never going to hear the end of this.
My term in office has kind of been defined by disasters. When I first came in, it was 2008, and we had the financial disasters, and Duluth was kind of on the leading edge of that, and had some major, major budget challenges. Then the largest natural disaster in our city's history with the 2012 flood, and then leading all the way up to the present moment and having this microphone disaster continuum here. So, and they are trying to figure it out, but this actually allowed me to stand and not be tied to a microphone and kind of address you. So I was so impressed with the report that I saw from the EQB. Just a visionary approach to very important issues in the state of Minnesota. I applaud your efforts and certainly whatever we can do in the city of Duluth to promote these efforts, this wonderful report, and keep us on track to achieve the national leadership that we know is possible in the state of Minnesota. I think we're on that track already because of the leadership of people like Senator Anderson and Yvonne Kretner-Solin that we're very proud of, and yet we know that there's more work to be done. I do want to touch on the 2012 flood and kind of give you a reminder of what we saw during that flood, also as a reminder to us all about what the stakes are when we are considering the impacts of climate change and the importance of the steps that we need to take going forward. And sometimes very difficult steps, sometimes very challenging and expensive steps to take. And yet when you compare that to the cost of disasters like we saw in the Duluth area in 2012, they pale in comparison. And we know that these type of storms, these type of disasters are only increasing in their frequency and increasing in their intensity. So the rain fell. I was downtown on June 19th meeting with a small group, and it began to rain. And it was a very hard rain. I got drenched running back to the car, but it wasn't uncommon. I didn't feel it was uncommon. I woke up the next morning, and I was all of a sudden in the flood recovery business. And driving down to City Hall that day and seeing chunks of street coming down our hillside, seeing utility hole covers being blown off, and just a sense of tremendous devastation. And as we saw later in the day, that devastation continued as we began to take stock of how bad the storm actually was. So there were sections in the city of Duluth in which we had 10 inches of rain in a 24-hour period. And sometimes when I think about that statistic, it still blows my mind. You know, we'll often hear about a heavy downpour in which they got, you know, 2 or 3 inches in a short period of time. And that's a significant storm. But 10 inches of rain in a 24-hour period was simply unheard of in the city of Duluth and for our region. So we saw significant, in the city of Duluth, an important part of our stormwater system is our creeks. And we have essentially 40 creeks that enter either into the St. Louis River or Lake Superior. Each one of these creeks acts as giant funnels for stormwater. And so the stormwater gets controlled within the neighborhoods, enters into the stormwater system or through culvert systems, and then it's funneled down to these massive creeks that in many cases then go under our road system that goes east to west. Lots of culverts, lots of bridges in the city of Duluth, and it was that system of these creek systems and the culverts and the bridges that the water had to go under that were stressed. And here's a picture of the streams. The important thing to remember about our stormwater system is that it was built largely in the 1800s, especially down near in our downtown and in our traditional neighborhoods. And that was built at a time that certainly the severity of the storms were less. But more importantly, we didn't have the same type of development on top of the hill. The Miller Hill Mall area was essentially the flat, swampy area that acted as a giant sponge. So anytime we had a rain event, the rain would be captured and held on top of the hill and then would kind of drain down the hill later on. Well, now, over the past 30, 40 years, we've seen a tremendous amount of development a lot of impervious surface in this area. And so now when we have a heavy rain event, that water moved very quickly off those parking lots and into our streams. This is a picture of the St. Louis River. You can just see kind of the power that we were talking, that we saw. Obviously, the St. Louis River is the primary tributary into Lake Superior on the western end of the lake. In a little bit, you'll see the swinging bridge in Jay Cook Park, which was destroyed during this flood. It's now rebuilt, and we're proud of that. So we can just kind of continue forward. This is an example. This is the co-op near 4th Street, a massive retaining wall. Again, the retaining wall was built over a stream. And for the average Duluthian, they had no idea that there was a stream that came under 4th Street and through the co-op parking lot. But during the flood, became very much aware of where these all too small culverts were under our city streets and under, in many cases, private property as this was. Tremendous devastation to homeowners, especially that lived along the creek. Duluth's flood was a flash flood, and so most of the damage occurred in a very short period of time. A lot of erosion problems that affected private property. However, we did have some traditional flooding, especially in our Fond du Lac neighborhood on the very southern end of town, and we saw kind of the devastation to homeowners and the difficulty that we had in working with FEMA to get support for homeowners. And so, in the strange way that they look at basements and not reimbursing for damage to basements, and of course, the value of all those personal belongings and photographs and that were lost during this flood. This is Feisty the Seal, who became a celebrity when this picture was taken, escaped the zoo, and ended up on Grand Avenue and when this picture was taken in the very early morning of June 20th. This is a picture, as we had mentioned before, about the Milligram Mall area on top of the hill. This is near the Target. This is Grandma's saloon up on top of the hill. And just see the depth of the water. This was actually a very problematic picture for our community, just as an aside, that people saw the water that high, and they saw Grandma's in the background. And so for the visitors across the state, they said, Canal Park must be underwater. And yet it was up by the mall, and that was part of the very delicate position that city leaders were put in that time, to both say, yes, there's a tremendous amount of damage, yes, we're focused, yes, there are some unsafe areas, but we're also in the middle of our tourist season, and we need to say that Duluth is open for business, and that was a very delicate dance for us. This picture shows the St. Louis River estuary. The Long Bridge is the Bomb Bridge that connects West Duluth to the city of Superior, and you can see the amount of sediment that came in to the estuary, and we're still dealing with some of the after effects of having that much volume of sediment entering into, you know, through our creeks and then entering into the estuary. Here's an example of some of the damage to a city street. This street was less than 5 years old when water was diverted from its normal course, entered into a street that couldn't handle that volume, and essentially just rippled right under the pavement and destroyed that street. This is the most common type of damage that we saw. Again, water that simply overwhelmed the culverts that we had in place, started to move around the culverts, kind of washed away the soils, and then eventually the street would collapse. Another example of that, more dramatic, and also the private property damage that we've seen. This is near my home. On the top picture, you see a car, and this is about two blocks from my house. This is Skyline Boulevard, and story, kind of a funny story, because nobody was hurt. But the car stopped on Skyline. two college-age kids kind of walked out, ran to a home across the street to pick something up. Another kid in the back seat probably texting or something like that, and all of a sudden the car starts sinking. And he's looking around saying, what is happening? Fortunately, he was able to get out before it went down another 5 feet, but you could just see, again, the devastation of that flood. And then very proud of our staff who worked so diligently to overcome these types of disasters and very quickly rebuild our infrastructure. Talking about the resiliency that we've been planning in the city of Duluth, a big part of that, of building in additional resiliency, is looking at that stormwater system. Both in terms of the resiliency of that green infrastructure and the stream beds across our city, making sure that they can that they are resilient and being able to handle larger volumes of water, as well as looking at the culvert systems, in some cases moving from a smaller culvert to a bridge system. One of our frustrations, I will point out, frustration for us is, as we recognize that the infrastructure that was in many cases overwhelmed was built in the 1880s, 1890s, and all the dynamics that were in place at that time, and there was a real desire by the city to say, we need to rebuild this, we'd like to build larger culverts. And yet, from FEMA's perspective, they said, we will help pay for the portion to rebuild exactly what was there before the storm. And we just scratch our head and say, you know what, we're trying to do as much as we can, we will do as much as we can, but we need the state and federal partners to meet us halfway and allow us to build in the extra capacity so that we have this resiliency and can avoid these expensive failures within the system down the line. This is Mission Creek out in the Fond du Lac neighborhood. The creek, there's an old historic bridge in Fond du Lac on the Mission Creek just before it enters into the river. There was a number of trees and brush that came up against and essentially blocked the culverts, and so the water then, instead of going through the culverts, ended up going into the neighbors. A great story of neighbors kind of banding together and putting up this berm that you see on the left side of the picture. Great story, but a lot of private property damage from that flood. But you can see the type of work that we've committed to in rebuilding that berm, as well as, again, adding that resiliency to the creek. This is Mission Creek a little bit further up the creek. You can see the damage on the right side where the bank was essentially eroded away. And this is a problem both in terms of the stability of the bank as it relates to the stream, but there's also a larger ecological problem that is created when you have this type of erosion and kind of exposed soils on the banks. The problem is that the sediment then, even a normal stream, to get higher volumes of sediment that are entering into the stream and compromising fish habitat, and then eventually ending up in the St. Louis River and causing depth problems there, as well as the washout that comes down that we want to avoid coming down. So the bank stabilization has been a real priority for the city, but again, kind of running into some problems on that front. It's very easy to negotiate with FEMA about a culvert or a street, because you can say, here's the street before, here's the damage that occurred, and here's the price tag for a contractor to rebuild this street. Well, when you have this sort of damage of a bank that has eroded in, and it becomes very difficult, because what was the condition prior to the flood? How do you, what is the strategy that you take to rebuild that stream? Do you build hard infrastructure, or do you build soft infrastructure? Working with the DNR to negotiate, what is a natural occurrence and what can be fixed through engineering means. Another culvert system. So the other part, we're certainly, after the flood, looking at the importance of us building resiliency into our stormwater, preparing for larger, more severe storms into the future. But we're also taking a broader responsibility, our part in the national and really global effort to reduce carbon emissions and to hopefully slow and then reverse the effects of climate change in our country. One of those projects that the city has recently committed to is called Portland State University has an Urban Sustainability Accelerator Program, bringing communities from across the nation to Portland State to kind of learn from the experts and explore ways that communities can kind of take initiative and contribute to the broader goal. We were very pleased to be selected into this program, and we sent a team out in July to participate, and they came back with a very strong action plan and a year's commitment to implement real change in our city. We've also committed to the Georgetown Energy Prize, and this is a contest, a nationwide contest put out by the Georgetown University, challenging communities to reduce energy consumption, especially at that the individual home level. And you know, oftentimes it's easy for communities to be committed to the large power plants, the heavy industry, and the public infrastructure, because we have either regulatory controls or tools that can be used, or we have the ability to make these investments directly. But how do we get to those homeowners? How do we reduce our reliance on fossil fuels to heat our homes, and especially in the state of Minnesota, and especially in cold weather communities like Duluth? It is imperative that we reduce our reliance on these energy sources. You know, not only because of the important environmental considerations, but also as looking at the long-term financial stability or sustainability of our community. If natural gas and oil prices double or triple or quadruple in the future, will folks be able to live in cold weather communities like Duluth? So, and that problem is compounded, or that threat is compounded, when you have a city that has a majority of the single family homes that were built prior to 1940. And we have a very old housing stock, many of our traditional neighborhoods, low income people that have very inefficient homes. And so our challenge is, how do we get to those folks to make energy improvements that will have immediate payback to their bottom line, and reducing our carbon emissions or our carbon consumption at the same time. There's a pretty picture of Duluth. So, you know, when I take a look at, again, the report that this group has put out, we see firsthand the importance and our commitment both to be part of the solution, to our commitment to the important goals that were set out, but also because we have, in the very recent past, a clear example of the devastation that has been caused. And unfortunately, we see time and time again, you know, last summer, the city of Boulder, a very similar flood to the city of Duluth, and just the devastation that caused. I know that you toured the steam plant, and this is one that I am extremely excited about, and is a priority project for the city of Duluth. And I won't go into detail because I know that you have had this conversation, but the symbolism is really important here. Currently, we have a coal-fired steam plant on the shores of Lake Superior, and we are taking the coldest, freshest water in the world, and we're bringing it into this steam plant and using coal to take that very cold water and rise it to the level of steam, and then setting it out into a very inefficient and leaky system in which the steam is then consumed, and then very warm, if not hot, water is sent into either the sanitary or stormwater system. And that energy that is in that hot water is gone forever. And in fact, it is a detriment to both the sanitary and the stormwater system because it is so warm going into there. Making the commitment to on two different fronts. One, to move away from the use of coal, using biomass, using solar, using natural gas as part of the mix and moving away from coal, but more importantly, committing to the conversion from a steam system to a hot water system so that you start with warm water, you raise it from warm water to hot water, you send it out into the system, you have no leakage, the energy is consumed, and then it comes back in a closed loop system to that hot water plant. And then you have warm water that, again, you're raising to hot water using much less energy. This is a major commitment, not only from the physical infrastructure that is needed at the plant, as well as the underground infrastructure, but it's also a challenge for those private property owners in our downtown that are currently on that system to convert their infrastructure to accommodate the hot water versus the steam. That's already a big vision, but we're exploring ways to even expand the scope of that vision. You know, can we work with Minnesota Power to do some cogeneration? Can we look to tap into our industrial port and maybe capture some waste heat from Ventec that bends massive pieces of steel? I'm not an engineer, but I know that there's a tremendous amount of heat that goes into the grain elevators. Is that an opportunity to capture some of the waste heat from the grain elevators and bring it in into the system? But the other opportunity with the closed-loop hot water system is to expand the footprint of district heat, moving into our industrial areas, moving into our Lincoln Park neighborhood, which is a distressed business district, and perhaps giving them some financial advantages to making this work. It is a large vision. It's a real challenge for a community like ours that doesn't have deep pockets or access to a lot of capital, but it's something that we understand is important for the future of our community, both environmentally, cost-wise, but also the importance of saying that we take our responsibility of being at the head of the greatest lake in the world seriously. And it's an embarrassment to our community. Just as it was an embarrassment that we allowed country to sewage enter Lake Superior, we fix that problem. It's that in the same way, it's an embarrassment that we have a coal-fired steam plant on the shores of Lake Superior, and so we're committed to solving that problem, getting on a better course for our community and for the state. So those are my comments. If there are questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you, Mayor Ness. Questions for Mr. Mayor? John Lankstein.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, and appreciate your holistic view of systems in the city and how they either do or don't work together at the present time. I'm interested in where you see, and we've really appreciated your partnership on cleanup activities in the estuary and the St. Louis River. And just I've heard a little bit about your vision for the river and for recreation. I'd like to hear just a little bit of what you see coming for the citizens and for the environment in that regard.
Yeah, thank you. It's something that I'm very excited about, what we call our St. Louis River Corridor Vision. And a lot of focus has been on the recreational side and the environmental learning side, certainly an important part, especially as we try to bring additional visitors to that area. But that's actually a secondary or even tertiary goal of this larger vision. The primary goal is the cleanup of the St. Louis River estuary. Currently, it's one of the largest areas of concern along the Great Lakes. And for starting with the great late great Willard Munger and his commitment to bring attention to the damage caused to the environment in the St. Louis River because of all the industry in that area, and continued on for many leaders in this room today that have been committed to this cleanup effort. We're now on track to delist this area of concern. And I keep going back between, 2025. Okay. Now, somebody had told me that 2020 was our goal, but now I'm here in 2025.
We'll clarify that.
All right. I'll say 2020, just as a challenge goal. All right. And to get the dollars flowing. But we do have a great, tremendous opportunity to accelerate that cleanup effort for two primary reasons. One, the Great Lakes Restoration dollars made possible through from Congress. They're actually doing something on this issue and creating some very important dollars to assist communities like Duluth and Superior in the cleanup effort, as well as the legacy dollars. And the partnership that we have, the MPCA and DNR, has just been fantastic. So the cleanup of the river is first and foremost. Second is looking to breathe new life into the brownfields. For example, the old U.S. Steel site that has now been vacant for the last 35-40 years and has been kind of this embarrassment or blight on the community. We're finally now getting U.S. Steel to come to the table, committing both to the waterside cleanup because of the availability of the Great Lakes Restoration dollars, but as well as working with our Port Authority to start moving some of the brownfield into developable sites that we can bring new industry to that area. The recreation piece, though, is the piece that I think most people are excited about. I'm really excited about the potential. Because Duluth has Lake Superior and the natural beauty there and the visitor infrastructure that we built kind of with the lake as a focal point, visitors from around the state don't even realize that we have this amazing resource in the St. Louis River Estuary. It is just a beautiful area. It's, you know, it's great fishing, robust trail systems that we're going to be investing in, and we want to make that kind of an active recreation with biking and hiking and bird watching and getting, encouraging folks to get on the river to kayak and canoe and make this cohesive whole. And one of the goals of this is to show the importance. Link the importance of the investment in environmental cleanup, both the river as well as the brownfields, and make a very direct link to economic and community benefits. The value of a person's home, the number of jobs that we can create in this area. And so that people see that direct, you know, that very direct connection between the importance of the work that stands alone, but also showing the economic benefits.
I'm curious, Mayor Ness, if FEMA did allow the additional capacity during your build-out. You indicated that you had some frustration. Did they eventually come around?
No, they didn't.
They didn't.
And, you know, and to be fair to the FEMA staff, I mean, that's what the legislation says.
Yeah.
You know, and they are charged with, you know, playing hardball with local units and really trying to limit the amount of expenditure to the greatest extent possible. You know, to our frustration, because, and, you know, well, I can't speak for them, but I would hope it's to their frustration as well, seeing what should be done, the right path to take, so that they don't have to come back in the next storm and rebuild that very same infrastructure. So I do think that will likely require legislative change at a federal level, or at, you know, I'd like to think that you could do that administratively, but I'm not sure what that would be.
Well, I suspect it's a matter of exposure for them, and I, you know, we saw additional flood damage this year. Fortunately, it wasn't here in the Duluth area, but southwestern Minnesota. I had the chance to travel with the governor to the far reaches of southwestern Minnesota, Edgerton, Laverne, and the devastation there was equal to the devastation that you saw during your time. Again, thank you so much for your willingness to host us, and congratulations on your rebuild to this great city of Duluth.
And thanks again for coming up to Duluth, and I hope that you'll come back soon. Thank you.
We shall. All right, let's move then to Professor Steve Coleman from the Large Lake Observatory, University of Minnesota, Duluth. And Professor Coleman, welcome, and you're going to give us a little sense of climate change and its impact on Lake Superior.
Where would you like me to stand?
Well, you know,
I'm told the mics are hot again, so do we have anything to do with the mics?
we have no audio at all, so you pick the, you know, that's fine. Anywhere, maybe where Mayor Ness was standing might be not a bad spot. You get both audiences.
Well, we're getting set up. I'd like to thank the board for inviting me to come and talk about Lake Superior today. Mayor Ness has given me a great introduction, and I'll try to take it from there.
Oh, that would be ideal. Okay, that's hot, right?
Yeah, we got 4 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about the impact of climate change.
You could use
Superior today.
I'm understanding that you could use the lectern mic, but that will take you away from your computer, I suppose. So.
Yeah, I'd like
okay.
to change the slide.
Fine.
So. Okay, I'll talk about the impact of climate change on the Superior, Lake Superior, but you can see that that's not what the title slide says. One of the points I want to try to make is that Lake Superior, like the oceans, is extremely resistant to change of any kind, simply because of its size, its mass, its thermal capability, massive thermal capacity. So for the last few years, I've been waging a sort of tongue-in-cheek, quixotic campaign to rename Lake Superior the Superior Sea. And you'll see why this becomes important in the story in a minute. So this is what I think. Let me also make a comment that I actually prepared this talk in a different format, and it has very nice animations and slide transitions. I had to translate it to PowerPoint, and it didn't work perfectly. I think the information is here, but it's going to be a little crude, so I apologize for that. Anyway, this is what I think most people think of when they think of a lake. This is Lake Minnetonka, west of the cities. It's a very nice lake. It gets warm enough in the summer to swim. It gets cold enough in the winter to go ice fishing. You can get out in your bass boat. It's a very nice lake. This is another lake. You can see there are more lakes in the background. Supposedly Minnesota's got more than 10,000 of these. Again, they're very nice. You can get in your canoe. You can get in your pontoon boat. They're a tremendous resource for the state. But I would submit to you that this is a different animal. This is, you can't see the other side. We don't use canoes or paddle boats or pontoon boats on Lake Superior. We have 1,000-footers instead. Despite last winter and the fact that we're so far north, the lake almost never freezes. There's a tremendous thermal mass in the lake that largely prevents it from freezing entirely, although in rare circumstances it does. And then, of course, we have storms. The gales in November, the many, many shipwrecks in the lake all speak to the idea that this is a different natural feature than what most people think of as lakes. And in fact, there's a scientific dividing line that we could draw. It's a little arbitrary, but what we like to think of is a large lake or a sea is one in which the rotation of the Earth actually affects the circulation in the lake. And that's true for Lake Superior in a major way. It's not true for smaller lakes. So that's our definition of lakes and streams. again, I'm going to explain a little bit of why that's important for the climate issue in just a second. One more way to impress on you the size and the mass of Lake Superior is this is a satellite view of the east coast of the United States. I can't really point to you, but it's Boston up at the top. You can see Chesapeake Bay. It goes down to about into North Carolina. This is Lake Superior at about the same scale. These were supposed to be juxtaposed, but basically Lake Superior goes from the equivalent of Cape Cod to the North Carolina-Virginia border. This is what we call, on the left is what we call the Mid-Atlantic Bight. It's a huge body of the ocean. We have essentially a small freshwater ocean sitting beside it. Okay, some fun facts. We always have to have fun facts when we give science talks. Lake Superior is the world's largest lake. Here are some of the facts. You may not be able to read these on these relatively small screens, but area-wise, Lake Superior is the largest lake in the world by a significant amount. It covers a larger area than any of the other lakes in the world. Can't quite see that. Is that the deepest? That's the deepest. I'll just mention that the deepest spot in Lake Superior is about 1,300 feet, a little bit more than 1,300 feet deep. This is not the deepest lake in the world, but 1,300 feet is nothing to sneeze at, and about 700 of those feet is actually below sea level. So it's a pretty significant deep and volumetric water. The volume of water contained in the lake is just almost an incomprehensible number. It's again, I don't expect you to read that, but it's 11,400 cubic kilometers, if that means anything more than the several quadrillion gallons that's up there. But and in fact, it's 10% of all the surface freshwater on the planet. You've probably heard that statistic before, but to me that's just astounding. We have one lake that's got 10% of all the freshwater on Earth. The last statistic I'd like to point out is that the average residence or retention time of water in Lake Superior is about 200 years. That means that any molecule of water that flows into Lake Superior or falls into Lake Superior from the sky spends about 200 years before it either evaporates or flows out to St. Mary's River. Another way to think about that is that if you instantaneously emptied the lake and kept precipitation and evaporation the same, it would take 200 years to fill it back up again. Again, these are almost mind-boggling statistics, I think, but they all speak to the size and the mass and the capacity of the lake. Mayor Ness showed the same slide. I'm going to take a little bit different perspective on this. You know, the floods of June 2012 were spectacular. There's no question about them. It was disastrous for the city. It caused incredible amounts of damage. It's been estimated hydrologically to be a 500-year storm. That is that the chances of it happening in any 1 year. The chances are that it would only happen once in every 500 years. It was a really, really significant hydrological event that had large, large human impacts. We got out on Lake Superior the day after the flood, and with no funding at all, started measuring the effects of the flood. And there were some effects related to nutrient flows, in relation to turbidity and sediments, but they were relatively small. And in fact, this satellite image, which shows the muddy water in the western arm of Lake Superior off the St. Louis River, is spectacular, but look at the rest of the lake. You know, the visible effects are confined to a relatively small area of the lake. And in fact, the lake rose a few inches for a few days. That was the impact on the larger lake. Now look out at the center of the lake. Did it see the impact of this tremendous hydrological event? Probably not, or at least we probably couldn't measure it. All this, again, going to the point that it's very difficult to disturb a body of water the size of Lake Superior. But it is changing. And before I do that, let me, in case you haven't heard of the Large Lakes Observatory, let me just mention quickly that LLO is a research institute at the University of Minnesota Duluth. It's a relatively, that's our faculty of a couple of years ago. It's a relatively small institute. And basically we're an interdisciplinary oceanographic institute. And very much along the lines of Woods Hole Oceanographic, if you've heard of that, or Strix Oceanographic Institute on the West Coast. Of course, we're much smaller, but we have the same basic scientific interdisciplinary mix of specialties, all focused on a body of water, or bodies of water. Actually, we work a lot on Lake Superior, but part of our modus operandi is that we work all over the world. So these are some of our research sites that are part of our global research program. We operate a research vessel that's part of the national, there's about 28 vessels in the national academic research fleet, and we operate in one of them. It's the only one on the Great Lakes. It's called the RV Blue Heron. If you're in town next Friday, there's an open house if you'd like to see it. We use oceanographic style instruments and sampling devices. We get out on the lake on this research vessel. We even have cutting edge oceanographic instrumentation like this autonomous underwater vehicle that goes out by itself. So that's what we do, and that's why we're interested in Lake Superior. And despite what I said earlier about the lake being so resistant to change because of its size, it is in fact changing. And you can't read all the data there, but the data on the bottom half of the slide is actually for the Great Lakes as a whole, not for Lake Superior. And on the left is the cumulative number of invasive species that have been introduced to the Great Lakes. Okay? I'm not going to talk about that. That biology, it's had a tremendous impact on the ecosystem. On the right is the yearly load of nitrate, a fertilizer, to the Great Lakes. And again, it's been rising with a great deal of ecological consequences. What I was asked to talk about here today, though, is climate change and the effect on the lake. Keeping in mind the very, very large and difficult, resistant to change size that Lake Superior gives it. So for Lake Superior, we have temperature records that go back about 110 years. These are daily temperature measurements that were measured at the outlet at Sault Ste. Marie. So we have somewhat of a long-term perspective on that. That's the curve in blue here. So I'd like you to notice two things. One is that for almost a century before 1980, there was very little change. Almost all the change we see has come in the last 35 years or so, since 1980. That's that upward trajectory on the blue curve. The other thing to note about Lake Superior is the lighter line. The heavy line is an average, a decadal average. The light line is the yearly values. So there's a lot of year-to-year variation. And anybody who lived in Duluth for the last winter, well, even I was questioning whether global warming was real after trying to survive this past winter. So no matter what happens, we're going to have cold winters and we're going to have warm winters. And that year-to-year variation is what you see there in the light blue line. For comparison, the red line is the northern hemisphere average air temperature record. This is what people talk about when they talk about global warming. It too was mostly pretty flat until about 1980. And at this scale, it's gone up in the last 30 years, but it doesn't appear to be going up that much. It's As of when the slide was made, it was less than a degree centigrade. It's up to something approaching a degree centigrade now. So I want to talk about the difference between those two curves and why we find Lake Superior so interesting in its response to climate change. So in order to do this really well, I'd have to give you a little bit of a course in physical limnology. I won't really try to do that. I don't want to take up too much time here, but and I can't really point. So the critical thing is that the lake becomes stratified in both the winter and the summer because of the fact that the temperature, the density of the water is controlled almost entirely by temperature. And the temperature of maximum density of the water is about 4 degrees centigrade. That's about 39 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay? So whenever water gets near that temperature, it sinks. It's the maximum density. It doesn't matter whether it's getting colder or getting warmer, it sinks to the bottom. As a result, most of the deep water at Lake Superior is always at 39 degrees. And it's almost impossible to change that. You can change the upper water temperature, but you can't change the deep water temperature. Anyway, the time during which the lake is cooling in the winter or warming in the summer, well, we refer to the stratified season. And it's the second slide over from the left on the top. Shows what it diagrammatically looks like. You have warm water up to about 65 degrees Fahrenheit that circulates because of wind mixing, but it's less dense and sits on top of the cold water. The length of time that it turns out that the length of time that the lake is stratified is one of the things that controls what the temperature actually gets to. If we have a short stratified season, it never warms up enough. The water temperature never quite catches up to the air temperature. If we have a long summer, a long stratified season, then no matter what the air temperature does, the water can warm up somewhat. Okay, I probably confused you, but let's move on. Another thing to look at, the red curve shows what the surface water temperature does on a yearly cycle. This is a 2008-2009 one-year cycle. So if you start from the left, the red line is warming slowly to that dashed line, which is that 4 degree centigrade line. When it gets to that line, the lake begins to stratify and the surface water gets really warm. That's that big red spike. In the fall, it starts to cool down. It crosses that 4 degree line. Comes down to the bottom, it can't get below 0 degrees or it freezes and forms ice on the lake, and it starts the same thing again. And there's two things that are important. One is the air temperature that the water is seeing. The other thing is the length of this stratified season. We're sort of understanding this all after the fact, after things we've learned in the last 6 or 7 years. I'll show you why that's important. We really didn't understand this entirely 10 years ago. The date of the onset of the stratification is closely related to how much ice there was the previous winter and how warm it is in the spring. But you can see, again, a lot of year-to-year variability. These are three different buoys out in Lake Superior. But the trend from left to right is definitely downward. This means that the onset of stratification of the lake is occurring at an earlier and earlier date, on average, every year. A lot of year-to-year variability. It didn't start to stratify until almost August this year, because it was such a cold winter. And this is very closely related to the temperature that the lake gets to. So if you can see there's a big dip in the upper graph, about in the middle, where the lake stratified very early, and the corresponding summer water temperature for that year is very high. There's a very close correlation between those two. And this is kind of the kicker slide. If you look at the whole Bowie record, when we published this in 2007, it made all sorts of national news. CNN was here, NBC News was here. Duluth a lot of nice publicity. Basically, the top slide is the, if you look at it, just drawing a straight line through it, that's the rate at which the air temperature, just in the Lake Superior region, not the Northern Hemisphere, but just in the Lake Superior, the air temperature is that red line. The summer water temperature is the blue line. And if you're not used to looking at these things, those two lines may not look too much different to you, but actually the rate of warming of the water is twice as fast as the rate of warming of the air. And that's totally counterintuitive. We expect the air temperature to be what's driving the water temperature. So how could the water temperature be rising faster than the air? There was a real conundrum until we started teasing apart, gathering more data. And that was actually a feedback loop which had been proposed for the ocean, but we had no idea it worked in the lake, the large lake anyway. And the graph on the bottom there is the ice cover on Lake Superior through time for the last 30 years or so. And you can see, again, lots of year-to-year variation, but the trend is definitely downward. We've gone from something on the order of 26% integrated over the winter down to about 11%. And the, again, what, as I said before, the amount of winter ice and the onset of summer stratification and the length of the heating season are all closely related. So the feedback is that the air is going to warm the water sort of on a one-to-one. The length of the heating season is going to allow the water to warm more. So you actually double the effect. About half of it is due to just direct heating because the atmosphere is warmer. About half of it is due to the fact that the summer season is simply longer. And this was this made a lot of scientific news. And I think it's just an example of how we need to understand these systems better, because we, again, 10 years ago, we would not have predicted that these relationships existed, and it's only as global warming has proceeded that the magnitude of these changes has become large enough for us to really understand and measure. So, that's the take-home measure, the take-home message, that the surface water temperatures are warming twice as fast as so-called global warming, the warming of the atmosphere. And that's pretty amazing. Something I hope you'll remember, especially after I said how hard it was to change Lake Superior. So, now, I'd like to take this opportunity, if I could, to be a little provocative. No disrespect meant at all, but obviously I wouldn't ask this question: does Minnesota appreciate Lake Superior? If the answer were an unqualified yes. I think there's some lack of appreciation by the state as a whole for both the economic engine that Lake Superior is for the Northeast Minnesota region and the priceless natural resource that Lake Superior has. I'll throw out a few examples. And this is cherry picking. I realize it's not nearly as simple as I'm going to make it. But nevertheless, this report that I show on the slide was something that the state paid $750,000 to a group to come up with essentially a mapping of the future for Minnesota state water resources. This report, several hundred pages, does not once directly measure Lake Superior, mention Lake Superior. I was astounded. I wrote comments, nothing happened. And I don't think, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't think this is anything intentional. I think it's indicative of a kind of mindset that way up there in the north, and it's underwater, so it's not as much in our attention. I won't name the department that's
well, it looks like agriculture.
The logo does not show the 2% of the lake. 2% of the state is under Lake Superior, and it doesn't appear on the state map.
It's just blue. You can't see it. It just blends in the background.
This is a trivia issue. I'm not criticizing anybody. But again, I think it does speak to a little bit of a mindset that somehow Lake Superior is not entirely in the state consciousness. The map on the right is something produced. It's one of a whole bunch of very useful and excellent maps produced by the Minnesota Coastal Management Program that shows, in this case, it shows in quite a lot of detail the environmental stress and index of environmental disturbance on half of the coastal zone. It shows the other half of the coastal zone in monochromatic blue, whatever that is. And again, I think this is some reflection of a mindset. It's actually pretty difficult to fully admit to being simplistic here. It's not easy to portray the kinds of things that are happening in the lake, and so much of it is unknown. But there's something about being up this far north and out of sight, out of mind, that I think leads to a little bit of a lack of appreciation for Lake Superior. I don't want to take it any further than that. I'm just trying to be a little bit provocative here.
See, what part is provocative now?
Okay. So I don't want to end on a negative note either, but I will say that I'll repeat the idea that, you know, I like to call it the Superior Sea. I would like everybody to pay attention and remember it. It's a tremendous economic engine, shipping, recreation for this part of the state. It's also just, you know, it's the biggest lake in the world. It's a tremendous priceless natural resource that we ought to pay a little bit of attention to. And when we speak in climate terms, this particular picture reminds us it's so big and so important that it actually creates some of its own climate. There's a so-called lake climate effect, where if you get northwest winds in the winter, you create your own climate on the south shore. So, with that, I'll stop, and I'll be happy to answer any questions people might have.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for the presentation, provocative portions included. Thank you. And I assume maybe there's at least one commissioner here that wants an opportunity to read that. Or did you do that already?
No, I think you could look at all of the state logos and find it very comparable.
I suspect.
I think the state seal might even have the same thing. Yes. So this goes back to the state. Yeah.
It was an easy target.
Questions for Professor Coleman? Eric?
The slide that really struck me was that temperature cycles at different depths from 100 to 2000 to 2009. And it was that lowering of temperature at the 50 meter depth that occurred in November. No, I'm sorry, increase. I don't know if you can get to the slide, so I'm not. But it was the direction of that curve at the time of the year. And I guess my question is, if you're seeing, because that was just for a one-year snapshot, and I'm curious if you guys have looked at in the long term, if there's a change, it's the green line. Do we see an increase in temperature?
The increase in temperature? That's fairly easy to explain. You're 50 meters down, say 180 feet. The lake stratifies, but it gets deeper and deeper and deeper. And that green reflects the time at which the so-called thermocline reached the depth of the sensor at 50 meters.
Sure.
So only for a very short part of the summer and only for a limited amount of time did the lake water warm up at 50 meters depth?
Sure, and I would suspect that's part of the lake turning over, right?
It was just before the lake turned over, yeah.
I guess my question is if you can see any change in amplitude of that gradient line?
Interesting, you should ask
or along the time of seasonal, if it starts occurring in September, December, if you're seeing any changes along those.
The reason I'm glad you asked that question is it goes to the point that Lake Superior is incredibly understudied. So virtually all of the data except this slide comes from surface buoys that are just measuring the surface water temperature. We actually have almost no water temperature at depth. We started measuring, our group started measuring it in about 2007. This is 2008-2009. So we just started, and we can't really address your question because we don't have enough data. We will eventually, if we have enough money to keep putting the buoys out. But you know, it's incredible how little information we have to address a question like that. We just scratched the surface, and we just started. We're now trying to calculate the heat content of the upper part of the lake. The question to answer questions like you asked, just to see what the larger dimensions are of this. All we've had to work with so far is the Sault Ste. Marie power plant water temperatures and the NOAA buoys that have been out there just measuring surface temperature for 30 years. So we've gotten a little bit of funding from the National Science Foundation to look at deeper depths and more complicated questions. But we've only just started.
Please, John.
Professor Coleman, the last sentence here says these changes have implications for global response to climate change as well as for the future of the ecosystem of Lake Superior. Could you comment on that?
Sure. Well, one thing most people ask is what's the effect on the ecosystem? And we really don't know. We're just beginning to understand what the physical changes are. As soon as you get to the biological changes, things get really complicated. We can say from first principles that almost all chemistry and biology are temperature dependent. So if you change the water temperature, you're going to have some effect. It's going to change the ecology. Trying to figure out exactly how it's going to change is pretty fraught with difficulty. Some of the immediate questions you might ask is the primary photosynthesis technology, is that speeding up or slowing down? We're starting to look at that, but we don't have a very good answer yet. People have asked questions like, lake trout spawning zones appear to be placed in places where there is typically a lot of ice, which protects the spawning beds from storms. So if there's less ice, is there going to be less spawning recruitment out of those spawning beds? I think those are fascinating questions. They're very difficult to really get a handle on. There are lots of people who are interested in these kinds of questions and trying to look at them, but they're very complicated as soon as you get into the biological systems. And I don't think I can give you a very satisfying answer other than things. If the temperature of the lake changes, all of those things will change in some way, and we can't predict exactly how that is going to go. Thank you.
Other questions? If not, I've got just one. You mentioned briefly, Professor Coleman, the increase in nitrates, and I read somewhere that Lake Superior had an increase, a fivefold increase in the last 100, 110 years.
Yeah, it's comparable to what I showed you.
So, where's it coming from? And is a fivefold increase from, you know, the turn of the century significant?
It appears to be very significant. It's not entirely understood where it's coming from. But a big part of it, we don't know the exact percentage, but I would say the majority of it coming is atmospheric deposition.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily sewage treatment plants, although those probably contribute a little bit,
yeah.
or even runoff from agricultural fields necessarily. we don't have a huge amount of agricultural fertilization in the Superior drainage basin. Some, but we know that there is overall an increased atmospheric load to every place, not just the lakes, but sure. the landscape in general. And that appears to be the majority of the source.
All right. Well, your love for the lake and your passion for the lake is very evident. And congratulations. Maybe a little more passion would be. No, you're very passionate about the lake. And thank you for taking the time to be here. And we so appreciate your presentation. Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you. We're pleased also to have Nelson French with us today, and Nelson is going to give us a little sense of the St. Louis River area of concern and the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative Priority Project.
Great. Well, I'm walking up, and I suggest if anyone wants to stand, and do a jumping jack.
Yeah.
And we're in the middle of an afternoon with a great view. So.
Thank you for being here, Nelson.
Well, thank
good
you for
good to see you again.
It's wonderful to be here to see so many friends and old ones and hopefully some new ones. So. And hopefully I will project up all right here. It is a great honor to be here. I was going to be accompanied by my counterpart from the DNR at Collins. He had a conflict and sends his regrets. So we're pleased to be here to talk a little bit about this big effort. And there's going to be a threat of climate change in here, but that's not.
Is it provocative? We want provocative.
It's going to be very cool, I hope. But you have to tell me how cool it is.
All right.
So basically, I'm Nelson French, Lake Superior Unit Supervisor of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and we're working collaboratively with many concentric circles of interested parties to work on this important effort in the St. Louis River area of concern. Essentially, it's an area larger than this estuary, but much of the work is focused in the working harbor at the estuary here. And as you see on this cover slide here, we'll talk a little bit more about the perfect storm. We have the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative and the Minnesota Legacy funds and resources available, which our citizens were so graciously provided us with their vote in 2008. So, as I mentioned, the St. Louis River Concern is a true partnership in all respects. I would be going to a very long slideshow if I listed all of the partners, but the core business partners are the Pollution Control Agency, the Wisconsin DNR, the Minnesota DNR, the Fond du Lac Band, and then our four federal partners, which you see listed on this slide. In addition to these, we have many non-governmental organization partners, local units of government, the city of Duluth, as the mayor mentioned, and I have to say, having the mayor and his vision in Duluth has been extremely helpful for our efforts in recognizing that this effort is the core foundation of the vision and the work that he and his friends in the neighborhood are creating here. And it's very exciting to be part of this effort. So, as we look at the area of concern, I'll get into defining to you what it, how it came to be and what it was, for what and what it is. So we'll go through the fact that this area, as the mayor mentioned, we're going to talk about 130 years of history here in a quick period of time. It won't be kind of the glacial stuff, but we can talk about it at the lake level. But it will be the human history of this area, the European settlement history of this area. So there was a legacy of settlement and development prior to environmental regulation, which meant that things happened and we have residuals from those things, and that's part of what we're trying to address here. We'll then talk a little bit about the post-environmental regulation era, after the passage of the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, and all of the associated Minnesota statutes related to that. Describe the recent history, which is what has allowed us to be here today to talk about the future. So, going back in time a little bit, to the lake that the mayor mentioned, the infrastructure here, which we saw wonderful pictures of, was built in the late 1800s. So we can see from this slide that the infrastructure, by 1865, we had the road going out onto Minnesota Point. We had Superior Street out here already in place. And so the infrastructure of this community was beginning to build early on. But we see we still had wetland systems listed in the harbor, and there were going to be things to come because this area was ripe for development, given all the natural resource richness of the region. So by 1890, you can see that those wetlands in those areas were filled, slips were put in, and the bustling commercial activity of the logging industry and the mining industry and all the associated support mechanisms went into place. So at that time, there was significant alteration of the resources here, habitat alteration. Again, no regulations saying that you couldn't do it or you had to mitigate what you get, but these things happen and essentially compromise some of the ecological values of the estuary. In addition, as part of those developments came about, we had some large industries who, it's interesting to note that in 1907, the state legislature passed a non-processed mineral export tax, which forced U.S. Steel to construct the U.S. Steel plant in the St. Louis River for the sake of employment and jobs in the community. Same stories that we hear all the time. Not that that was a bad decision, but the state essentially authorized this and had this structure built starting about 1915, worked for about 50, 60 years, again, prior to the era of any environmental regulations. So the U.S. Steel facility did, essentially, you can see here at the height of its operation, it was actually discharging a fair amount of nasty stuff into the estuary. And part of our effort here, the bulk of our effort, is to clean these sites up and move forward with a healthier ecosystem in the river. So that's sort of the past. I just pick a couple of these things. There were developments on the Wisconsin side and the Minnesota side, and we had all kinds of alterations in habitat and systems, and addition of chemicals, metals, and things to the system. But the present day, we now have environmental regulations in place. We have a view of the estuary that the mayor was describing. Look at that. That's a place to look at. It's as beautiful as Lake Superior. Kayaking, canoeing, bird watching is going to be an important part of the future of this area. In the 1970s, of course, we had the Clean Water Act in particular, which then led to the development in 1979 of the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District, which really addressed many of the nutrient issues that were being faced in this estuary. And within 3 or 4 years, we know the fish populations rebounded because the water had oxygen again, and even though there was a history of stormwater, sewer overflows went up until 5 or 6 years ago, the river was a much better place after this facility went in. So the Clean Water Act, which I think is important to remember that John Blotnick, the congressman from this area, was the chief house author of the Clean Water Act. And I think there's a reason for that, given this resource that he had to look out over, and the fact that we saw that some of that resource had been compromised by the effects of human development and business activity. So a part of that history, too, is that President Nixon vetoed the Clean Water Act in 1972. Congress overrode that veto, but showing that all people, including Dick Nixon, learned. Later that year, he signed willingly the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement, which is what brings us here today. The Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement is a joint agreement between the U.S. and Canada, and it's been amended several times. It focuses on the Great Lakes ecosystem. It's a hugely important document. There are, I'm forgetting now, Suzanne, there are 10 annexes dealing with various issues. One of the annexes focuses on these areas of concern and the topic I'll be getting into a little bit more today. So Pierre Trudeau and Richard Nixon signed that agreement in 1972. It was revised in 1987, which is when the topic of areas of concern were identified. And through that process, which involved the International Joint Commission, Environment Canada, the EPA, and a plethora of other parties, 43 sites across the Great Lakes were identified as areas where these legacy contaminants and legacy habitat alterations had adversely affected the system and needed to be addressed. So essentially, you can see that we're the furthest west and we're the only U.S. area of concern on Lake Superior. We share several with Thunder Bay, Nipigon Bay, Jackfish Bay, and I'm not sure what that one. Anyway, we've got 4 or 5 AOCs on Lake Superior. Now, so that agreement, the annex at the time dealing with this issue was Annex 2. They identified impairments, and you know, you can hear the words beneficial use impairments, but technically they found 9 of a potential 14 things wrong in this area, things that were the resources that had been compromised. And so this was designed and developed through a long process which involved local agencies, community stakeholders. These 9-year issues were identified, and the reasons for the listing of these impairments was well documented, and it's our job now to take care of these issues, address them, and get them off the list. That's what we're doing right now. So the area of concern is the largest in the Great Lakes. It spans a significant area of the region. It includes all of the Nemadji watershed, a portion of the St. Louis River from essentially the Fond du Lac Reservation down to the its junction with the Place Superior, and it includes a small part of the South Lake Superior watershed as well. But as I mentioned, the primary issues that are being addressed related to those impairments are in the harbor area or the estuary area. That's where much of the focus of the report is. So, come along the Bush administration back in the second term of the Bush administration, in particular, the Great Lakes Collaborative was established, which then led to the development of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative when the Obama administration came in, and the actual appropriation of dollars by Congress to get work done across the Great Lakes. One of the major priorities of work in the Great Lakes Restoration Action Plan is the cleaning up of the toxics in the areas of concern and restoring wetlands and other habitats associated with those areas of concern. So the Great Lakes Restoration Mission used $475 million in federal money in year one through EPA, then parceled out to the 15 or 16 other federal agencies under the premise that this was going to be a true collaborative, that the federal agencies were going to work better together to achieve outcomes and work with local municipal government and state agencies to get outcomes. So that Congress has appropriated $300 million almost every year since the authorization. So we're in year five of that effort right now, and they're looking at extending it another 5 years and at the $300 to $350 million a year level. So that, combined with our legacy funds, provides a perfect storm where we as resource managers and folks in the community have the opportunity to not just get as much money as we can to do what we think we need to do, but actually design the vision for what should be done, and then go seek the level of funding that's required to actually do it. It's something that's very rare in anyone's career to have this situation happen. So, a year ago, July 31st or July 15th, the state of Minnesota and the state of Wisconsin and the Fond du Lac Tribe jointly released the Remedial Action Plan, which is seen here as the Implementation Framework Roadmap to Delisting, which is a very visionary plan and document for our work in this area. It's inclusive. It was developed by a cadre of over 70 or 80 local stakeholders, academics, and folks from within the community and the state and federal agencies. The plan is comprehensive and targeted. It identifies 59 specific actions that we need to take to take care of those 9 problems that were identified, those 9 impairments. It's aggressive. We've set some timelines here. The mayor wanted me to clarify. I remember when Don and I first started talking about this, he was thinking we'd be done by 2030, and we corrected him and said, no, 2025 is the date we'd like to be done by, and so he corrected his talking points. And then subsequently, we've been encouraged to set the goal of getting all the major work on construction of remediation and restoration done by 2020, and I'll delve into that. Essentially, 26 of those 59 actions are huge projects. One of the goals is to restore 1,700 acres of aquatic habitat in this area. That's a large acreage anywhere. And certainly, when you talk about restoring aquatic ecosystems, that's a fairly large and sizable acreage. We also need to remediate or take the contaminants out or cap them in a number of sites. So this map shows those approximately 26 sites where we need to do the work. The brown sites are the habitat restoration sites, the aquatic ecosystem work. The dark red sites are sites where remediation or cleaning up of contaminated sediments needs to occur. And essentially, we now have the roadmap to get this work done. We have The resources from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in collaboration with the Clean Water Fund to get the designs and the cost estimates ready for all of the remediation sites. We also have in hand funds from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, again leveraged with Clean Water Funds, to get all of the habitat restoration plans done for this area, and within the next year we will have cost estimates for what it's going to cost to do all of this work. So any questions as you look at this map? I mean, you can see the scope of the acreages that we're going to be covering in terms of either cleaning up by removing or capping contaminated sediments or restoring habitat. Any questions?
How about the restoration of habitat? Who owns that general area?
Well, essentially, the state of Minnesota, as I understand it, does technically own the bed of these public waters. Yeah. And if anything is placed on those, my understanding from talking with good counsel at DNR and others, is that the state owns whatever is put on top there of thereof. And so that question, this is a navigable water of the U.S., okay. So therefore it's controlled under those paradigms. The question of whether you have any management units associated with this or not is a separate issue, but the state of Minnesota does control these beds of public waters.
Mr. Nelson, I didn't realize the whole Imagine River was within the area of concern as well. Is there any, I can't tell from that, it looks like there's one little red line associated with Imagine. Is that the entire?
Well, what this map doesn't show well is there's a light beige tone in the Imagine watershed portion here. What we've tied, the action step in this plan associated with the Imagine is to make sure the goals established in the Imagine watershed plan are met. And those goals had to do, as I recall from my prior work with other organizations, with making sure there's a certain amount of forested habitat and that water retention systems are in place. So there is a connection to that. And most of that work, most of that focus is on the Wisconsin side, but that plan does cover both sides of both states. So we can get you more information on that. But essentially, it's tied to a previous plan that has targets. And
I recall, and I think this slide shows that there is a remediation project there in Crawford Creek too. There's a site that's got to be investigated and remediated on one part of a tributary of the Nemadji over.
Right, in fact, the EPA this year put $800,000 of funding into doing the characterization work there to better understand what the sediment, what the contaminant situation is there with Crawford Creek associated with a former chemical operation there. So, that is in the Nemadji watershed as well. So.
Other questions for Nelson? Kristen?
I've seen some maps. I'm wondering if in the beneficial use improvements, are there any agencies in Minnesota that overlap the areas of concern on wildlife?
Well, part of one of the next slide, you've anticipated the next slide I'm going to, which is those are the site-based actions. We also have area of concern wide issues. Things such as, there's an impairment related to the presence of fish tumors. So we're doing all the necessary work. We're entering next year our third season of field testing suckers and getting an understanding of whether the tumors there are caused by chemicals or they're caused by viral cause. And so we hope that impairment is the next one to be removed because we think the first 2 years of data are showing us that there's not a chemical-related problem, at least to date. So we have these very concerned wide issues we're working on. And one of those is development of a wild rice strategic plan for restoration and then implementation of those restoration activities. So I know the Minnesota Land Trust is already doing, in partnership with the tribes, a restoration effort this summer. There was some recent press on that. But part of this process was to step back and the DNR is coordinating a strategic plan so that we better understand where that rice is best restored versus just going out and doing it. So yes, that's a component of the effort. Does that answer your question? Yeah. And so there are other issues like we've got studies going on in partnership with the Corps of Engineers to better understand whether there actually is any, what is the nature of the biological uptake of the chemical contaminants. There's very little data, if any, on that. And so we've got a four-year study in play right now that's going to help us understand whether that is a big issue or not. So lots of interesting science going on, but all driven towards dealing with issues that get us to remove those 9 impairments over time. So as we go on here, we look at our main focus is what's called the listing area of concern. We want to make sure that happens by 2025. We would like the major work and construction on all of those remediation and restoration sites to be done by 2020. And if we do that and take those steps and follow on those area of concern wide actions as well, we hope to remove all of the beneficial use impairments by these targeted dates that you see here on this chart. I like to describe this chart as we have a plan with 59 actions. We have 9 things that we need to accomplish. And we just submitted this summer and had a public open house on it this summer, our first recommendation for removal of an impairment. And EPA has that in their laps right now, and we hopefully will be hearing soon from them as to whether they think the work has been sufficient to remove that impairment. We submitted that a year earlier than the plan called for because the team got the data together. You know, we've got an A-squad team working on this. It's really exciting. So we have these 9 things we need to remove. We have the general pathway as to when we think we can get things done that will allow us to remove them. And it's basically a business plan. The cost of this is going to be, for Minnesota, $200 million, combined federal and state funding. And Wisconsin is going to be probably on the order of $100 million, roughly. And that's not including a couple of the remediation sites may have a responsible party, like U.S. Steel does. U.S. Steel will be paying for much of the cost, or if not all of the costs associated with cleaning up that site. But the tiger is in the tank. The engines are running, and I can't explain to you how much the perfect storm has arrived with the Great Lakes Restoration funding and the Minnesota Legacy funding, and it's a matter of the human team we've assembled putting these things together, following this plan, and getting the work done. So it's the most exciting thing I've worked on in my career.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Nelson, thanks. And it is a perfect storm, but it's more of a gentle rain than a cataclysmic event, I hope. You did a quick review of the numbers there. I just want to remind, I think the total cost we talked about somewhere in the neighborhood of $400 million. When you add up the private responsible party costs, in addition to the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative costs, the other costs that the Clean Water and Legacy funding will provide. So just if you can just quickly summarize how those costs break down again.
Sure. And let me do a little bit of a backstory. You know, there wasn't a good accounting system, and we're still working on getting the perfect one. But we did a little back counting, and we already expended upwards of $450 to $500 million in this place. I mean, Westminster Sanitary District was not in expense. So we're building on some of those prior investments. So roughly, and I can speak more accurately to the Minnesota side of the equation here, we've roughly estimated, without talking out of school, that U.S. Steel remediation may cost upwards of $100 million. That's ballpark. But that's between the responsible party and the EPA and the PCA to work out exactly what that's going to be. And then when we take a look at the restoration site work that is not currently funded, Radio Tower Bay is fully funded right now, and that project is moving forward. DNR is moving forward with state and federal funding to get that work done. We estimate about $94 million, roughly. But that's before we work out the final designs and identify any cost savings associated with how we design these things. And then the remediation work for the Superfund or the contaminated sediment sites is going to be on the order of $75 to $100 million. And if there are no responsible parties or if decisions are made that it's important to get the outcome sooner rather than later, the public investment would be paid for 65% by the Federal Great Lakes Legacy Act and 35% from local sources, whether that's a responsible party volunteering and stepping up and covering that cost, or the state of Minnesota through a bond initiative or something, putting that money forward. And so, John, does that get at the...
Yeah, that's good. Thank you.
And what's I think very interesting about this, and my glass has never been half full, as many of you know, the federal EPA has indicated that for the remediation site work, they can cash flow up to $65 million over a 6-8-year period to pay their share of that work. As we get these numbers vetted, the plant's done, they're there for us. Similarly, EPA, through their federal partners, and the principal ones for us are the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which I can't speak highly enough about, I'm drawing a blank on the other major partner is EPA, obviously. EPA. So those agencies have indicated that they can provide fundings, assuming Congress reauthorizes a 5-year extension of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative and appropriates the funding. But again, the glass is half full. We think they're going to live.
Minor issues.
Minor issues.
All right.
So any other questions?
Questions? Phil?
I was just wondering, I know in dealing with the Corps of Engineers, and you had on the last slide that I mentioned about this end of dredging, or at least a change in the dredging policy, and with respect to the Mississippi River, they're under federal requirements maintaining the 9-foot channel. I'm just wondering if they have similar requirements here and whether and how that allows the kind of progress.
Thanks for the question, Bill. Good to see you.
Yeah.
Yes, in fact, this is one of the, a very exciting story, is that this is the largest harbor in the Great Lakes. I believe it's the 18th largest harbor, it's the largest freshwater harbor in the world, and the 18th largest harbor in the world. This is a big place. Of course, when you measure stuff in tonnage and you're moving big rocks, it doesn't have to be. So, essentially, the Corps does maintain a navigational channel here. The use of funding from the dredge trust fund, basically, to do that work. And the win-win scenario that we have hit on here, as you know, that work and work on the Minnesota River, that one thing the Corps of Engineers does always and chronically is look for places to put that sand, right? That's the issue. Well, we have worked out the chemical analysis work so that we can analyze their dredge materials, determine whether they're acceptable for replacement in water. And so what's happening here, which is cutting edge for the Great Lakes, is the Corps of Engineers is essentially using their operation and maintenance funds. If you look out in by the Western Lakes Superior Sanctuary site, you'll see a dredge out there pumping material into the 21st Avenue West site. For no additional cost to the taxpayers or any of us, they're using their O&M money to move that material to that place to restore the shell we have. So in the last, they spent $1.3 million of their funds last year with $120,000 from the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative to pay for the silk curtain to manage the sediment, right? This year, they're putting in $2.1 million of their cost and $70,000 of Great Lakes Restoration funds. So this is one of those win-wins where you have the Corps of Engineers helping EPA and us to achieve our goals. It's sort of the essence of what that collaborative was all about. The federal agencies working together to do that. So.
Other questions for Nelson? Eric?
Just a real quick question. You mentioned there's a 5-year extension needed for funding.
Correct.
When does that expire?
Well, the first initiative was fiscal 10 through fiscal 14 of federal money. And of course, there's a 1-year delay. Their 10 money led to us being able to staff up and work up in 2011. So we have capacity funding to fund our staff teams through next September, and the authorization is up right now. And I understand there have been good discussions in the House and the Senate about reauthorization at the $300 million a year level. One of the big questions is that a 5-year deal or is it year by year? The last 5 years was year by year. So, for example, to fund our staff and the DNR staff working on this, we received a 5-year, $4.5 million capacity grant to fund the staff we needed to put all of this together and begin implementing it. But that was on a year-by-year basis. We get $900,000, and then you'd hope that the next Congress would approve it the next $900,000. One thing that is really nice from a geopolitical perspective about this work is it's got strong bipartisan support. The Ohio Republican delegation and the Great Lakes Caucus is very supportive of this work. So it's one of those rare, increasingly rare events where we've got everyone kind of singing to the same hymnal. And in some cases, the
The House Majority Caucus has actually put money back in after it's been cut by some of the other members of their caucus. So I'm confident that that with the Great Lakes team that's been assembled, that this will be something moving forward. I also just remembered, I forgot to mention that climate change thing. Didn't I say I was going to say something about climate change? Well, one of the neat things about all this remediation and restoration work is that under the Obama administration executive order, all of those federal agencies who are providing us resources, human and funding, are required to build resiliency and adaptation into any of their restoration or remediation designs. So we're incorporating the climate change issues into the work we're doing as part of what the consultants are being asked to do.
All right. Thank you very much, Nelson. You bet. Thank you. Let's move then to our last presenter, and I want to also remind there is a public comment period following our next presenter, and so if you have issues or questions that you wanted to raise with the board, there should be some pink sheets at the back table, so please fill one of those out. Okay, we do have them. All right. With that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Lee Frelick. Dr. Frelick is director of the University of Minnesota Center for Forest Ecology. Thank you very much for being here. And we're going to talk a little bit about climate change and its effect on our state's forests. Welcome.
Thanks for inviting me. I've been traveling for the last 3 weeks and haven't been home and just came out of the woods this morning. So, but I'm glad to be here, and I am going to go home. I am. So, we all know that global temperatures have been going up, as you see on this graph, and that will have an impact on forests, especially in a place like Minnesota where we're right at the margin between the prairie and the forest, and in fact, we can expect to have bigger impacts on forests here than any other place probably on the entire planet. Here are some projections for temperature. So I have a high emission scenario here on the upper graphs and a low emission scenario. Basically, the high emission is a business as usual, and by 2070 to 2099, we would be about 13 degrees warmer in the summer than we are now, and that would make Minneapolis about the same as Manhattan, Kansas, or make Duluth about the same as Omaha, Nebraska. And so you might ask the question, can you grow a boreal forest, a spruce and fir in that type of climate, or can you have moose? And the answer, of course, is no, you cannot. We also expect less precipitation in summer, even though we have more precipitation year-round. And that, again, would lead to a climate which is more like Kansas than like Minnesota. We think with the magnitude of temperature increase that we expect that we would have a 300-mile shift in the range of most species of trees. And in Minnesota, of course, we have the southern and western edges of the ranges of a lot of tree species. And so those species could shift right out of the state. And a good example would be balsam fir. And here you see the distribution of balsam fir today. The red areas are where it's high abundance. And then in the lower map, it shows a projection for a business-as-usual CO2 emission scenario. And balsam fir would shift out of the state. And along with that would go black spruce, white spruce, paper birch, balsam poplar, red pine, probably a bunch of other species, too, and all the birds, insects, fungi, mosses, and so on that are associated with those species. So here's the question, maple, spruce, or savanna? Right now, Minnesota looks like this. We've got the northern or boreal forest, which is the cold climate forest in the northeastern part of the state. Then we've got the deciduous maple, basswood, and oak going through the middle, and then the prairies in the south and west of Minnesota. And because we have those biome boundaries between temperate and boreal forest and between forest and prairie, we are exceptionally vulnerable to climate change. And in fact, this prairie forest border could shift completely out of the state. This diagram shows how the biomes are arranged. Let me bring up this star here, which is Minnesota. And you see we're right at the juncture of the boreal forest, which again is cold, where you have 9 months of winter and 3 months of summer, and temperate forest, which is a little bit warmer in the grasslands. So we're at an unusual juncture on this planet and are expecting very, very large changes in our forests as a result of that.
Sure. Dr. Fred, before you leave that slide, can you just, how did you develop the classification of what's where?
Oh, okay. Well, the x-axis has annual precipitation from deserts on the left to rainforests on the right, and then mean annual temperature. It's in degrees Celsius. Might make it a little bit hard to understand if you're used to Fahrenheit. It's hot at the bottom and cold at the top, so that's why we've got tundra is cold and dry, and evergreen tropical forest is warm and wet. Yeah, and then everything else kind of falls in between there, and Minnesota happens to be right at a spot where three biomes come together. We have a triple point, which is a pretty rare thing, especially when you don't cheat like they do in California and have mountains, you know, so you can get the biomes all over the place. We're just as good as California without having mountains.
I'm not sure we want to be there.
I knew you'd say something provocative.
Does that answer your question?
Thank you, yes.
Okay, and so here's where we might shift. So going down is warmer temperatures here, so we might shift down and have only grassland and temperate forest and be minus the boreal biome in the future. And that is one-third of all our native species that live in the boreal forest. Trees, plants, birds, animals, everything. And this is another depiction of the prairie forest border of the black line. The arrows show about where it would move by the end of this century with a business as usual scenario. So the boundary waters, the new area, would be right at the prairie forest border. Talk a little bit about these extremes that we've had, extreme warm, extreme cold, and that will also have an impact on Minnesota's biomes, having more of these extremes. Basically, if you have more extremes, it's more of a savanna-like climate. Forests tend to live in more stable climates, especially in terms of how even precipitation is over time, and they have less temperature extremes over time. So as the world warms, it's warming faster at the poles than the equator. That makes the jet stream go slower, and then it meanders more, and that gives us these big changes in the weather. When you're in the ridge underneath the jet stream, you have hot weather for weeks on end, like we did in 2012. And when you're in the trough, like we were all of last winter, you have colder than average weather. All these extreme switches from hot to cold or wet to dry will also work against forests. For example, March of 2012, we had magnolias in bloom on St. Paul campus of the University of Minnesota. And in 1988, when I decided global warming was real, which is about when most scientists decided that, I thought I would never live to see magnolias bloom in Minnesota in March. And I was wrong about that. I mean, it happened. The spring we had in March of 2012 would be about equal to an average spring in the year 2090. Now, what effect would that have on the forest? If you look at the bottom picture here, that's a spruce forest in Ontario near Thunder Bay, just north of Minnesota, after that extreme warm spell in March of 2012. And basically, a boreal forest of spruce and fir and jack pine does not know what to do with 80 degrees in March. Just can't respond to that at all. And so what happened is they started to grow, and then temperatures went back to normal, and then all of their needles died and fell off the trees. So you see miles and miles of brown forest there. Those trees are recovering now because we had two normal springs in a row. But as we get to a point where every spring is like that, it will only take three springs in a row like that, and it will wipe out the entire boreal forest in northern Minnesota in one shot. And then we have droughts, higher drought frequency, and you see here the dieback of birch on the North Shore. If you go up Highway 61, from Two Harbors up to Grand Marais. Well, that's due to the fact that the North Shore had a severe drought every summer for about 8 out of the last 10 summers. And birch is highly sensitive to drought. It's one of those species that needs an even supply of water. So that's why those are dying. Insect infestations will become more prevalent in a warming climate. If it does not get down to minus 30, for example, emerald ash borer will not be killed. If it does not get down to minus 40, the mountain pine beetle, which is the bug that is shown here, could come to Minnesota from the western part of North America. Not only that, with a higher drought frequency and more wind storms, the picture you see on the bottom left there, where you get big blowdowns followed by fire, that is a really transforming event in the forest. This particular forest shown here had been jack pine for about 7,000 years. But having it blow down in the 99 blowdown and then burn during a severe drought a few summers later has converted it to this regeneration here is cherry and aspen and red maple and things like that. So these big storms followed by droughts can also contribute to converting forests to other forest types or to non-forests. So we also have deer. Here it shows two pictures of a sugar maple forest in 1990 and 2006. And what happened between those 2 years is the deer basically had dinner, and as you can see, they ate all the sugar maple seedlings. All that green stuff on the forest floor in the upper picture is regeneration of sugar maple, which normally would have up to 1 million seedlings per acre. Very prolific seed-producing species. And has many, many seedlings waiting to take the place of any older tree that dies. Well, several years of drought and a high deer population led to the condition on the bottom there. There is no regeneration anymore. And we're just in the very early stages of climate change here. And we have worms, of course, global warming or global worming, it asks here. We don't have any native earthworms in Minnesota. Earthworms are ecosystem engineers. They alter the soil structure. They reduce water and nutrient availability. Nitrates, for example, leach out of the soil into the water when the earthworms invade. And we have a paper that we just put together that shows that they reduce tree growth by about 30%. And they have invaded basically about the southern half of the state, and in the northern half they're patchy. We just did a survey of the Boundary Waters, and probably about half is invaded with European earthworms. So that's our most remote wilderness area, and about half of it is invaded with European earthworms, which are going to make the soil more droughty and more nutrient poor. And they also warm up the soil. So in addition to warmer climate warming the soil, so will the worms. And they do that by eating the duff, which is the leaf litter layer on the forest floor, and that would insulate the soil and keep it cool during the summer. But the worms eat that. That's what they do for a living, is eat dead leaves, basically. So we've got all these factors. This is kind of a summary, more frequent and longer droughts. All the blue ovals here, exotic earthworms spreading faster, more deer, more fires, more storms, more pests and diseases. Those all work against forests, so it's everybody's talking about perfect storms. Well, this is a perfect storm against trees. I mean, you would not want to be a tree in Minnesota at this time because the climate will work against you and so will all of these other effects. I have a PhD student who has hundreds of temperature sensors out through northern Minnesota, and he found a 3 degrees Celsius, which is about a 5 to 6 degree Fahrenheit summer temperature difference between the Gunflint Trail and Ely in summer temperature. And that corresponds to a huge difference in the density of red maple, it works out to about several hundred per acre on the Gunflint Trail and several thousand per acre in the Ely area of red maple. Now, red maple is not a boreal forest species, it's a temperate species that is invading the boreal forest very rapidly at this point in time because the extreme winter minimum temperatures that used to limit red maple, which is about minus 45 Fahrenheit, which would kill the cambium and kill the bark and cause the tree to die, no longer occurs. Even last winter, which was the coldest winter we've had in quite a long time in Minnesota, it did not get cold enough to kill red maple, whereas the last really cold winter we had, it got down to minus 60 for the coldest weather station in the state. Last winter, the coldest reading at any weather station was minus 46. So the winter minimums have come up even when we have a cold winter, so no longer cold enough to kill some bugs, no longer cold enough to keep these temperate tree species like oak and maple out of the boreal forest. And here is red maple and red oak invading. In the lower picture there, you see all that red in the understory? That's a boreal forest with in the fall, with the red maple in fall color, just waiting for a storm to come along and knock that canopy over so the red maple can take over instantly. So here's northern Minnesota today. This is actually the spot I was at this morning. Believe it or not, before I got yanked out to come down here. And this is what it looks like. This is a boreal forest, a cold climate with red pine, jack pine, black spruce, and so on. Voyageurs National Park, for example, is boreal forest, as is the Boundary Waters. These are the tree species we have there, which I have just mentioned. Well, what are we going to get? What's the Boundary Waters going to be like if it warms up as much as we think it will? Well, we can go to the south and find areas that today have climates like the Boundary Waters will have in the future. And that's what these two stars show. The orange star is the Kennedy-Ojai Elm Forest, which represents the climate of the Boundary Waters perhaps 60 or 70 years from now, but on good soil. And the blue star, which is Nice Outcrops Natural Area, which represents the Boundary Waters several decades from now in a warmer climate, but on shallow, rocky soil. And this is the Kennedy-Ojai Elm Forest. So this is the type of forest you could have on a deep, silty soil with a much warmer climate. So it would be elms, fir, oak, hackberry, basswood, and Kentucky coffee tree. So these species, rather than the species I showed earlier. But on shallow rocky soils like much of northern Minnesota, it would look more like this. You warm up the climate on a shallow soil, and basically what you get is a savanna of juniper and bur oak with little blue stem and two species of prickly pear cactus. You can see it today at Nice Outcrops Natural Area near Granite Falls. Has the future climate of the Boundary Waters, the same type of rock, the same physiography with the hills and the shallow soil. And then there's some maple and oak woodland in the lowlands there. So these are some examples of changes in wildlife. And it shows on the top what we have now in northern Minnesota and what we would have with a much warmer climate. So black-back woodpecker going to red-bellied woodpecker, moose being replaced by deer. Lynx being replaced by bobcat. So wildlife species follow the habitat, right? They live in plants or eat plants or they require plants in some way. And so when the plants change, it has profound implications for wildlife. So here's the Boundary Waters today, and there is its future analogs in southern Minnesota. We also have fragmented a lot of fragmentation in southern Minnesota. A lot of species there will not be able to get to northern Minnesota because they're in little postage stamps. Maybe 300 or 400 savanna plant species are in little tiny natural areas in a sea of what I call the corn biome. Instead of the prairie biome, it's still grass, right? But it's corn now. How are those species going to get to the Boundary Waters? Well, managers will have to make that decision. They might have to give them a ride in the car, which is known as assisted migration. So here's a nice map, a biome map of Minnesota that welcomes you to the state. The MnDOT does really good biome maps, as you can see. So what do we expect here? In northern Minnesota, red maple will expand massively for now and later. May persist on deeper soil, on shallow or sandy soils. We expect oak savanna, so just think of the Boundary Waters redecorated as an old Savannah. It'll still be really beautiful. Savannahs are great. You just have to keep the buckthorn out and the other invasive plants that might jump in. We're likely to lose the boreal biome, one of our three biomes, and about a third of our native species in this state. So, we have time for a few questions.
Questions for Dr. Freeland?
I guess I have to disclose Dr. Frederick is my advisor for my master's program at the University of Minnesota.
What kind of student is he?
We don't know yet.
Talk to us. Yeah.
And thank you for coming.
Sure.
I'm interested in the earthworms, the European earthworms, which I guess are a problem. But I've heard something about an Asian earthworm.
Oh.
Could you comment on that?
Yeah, there are many, many species of Asian earthworms. They are used to create compost, and so instead of being distributed as fishing bait, they're distributed as compost. So a different distribution route. They are big, they are aggressive. They will tear up the soil even more than European earthworms. They're the dominant earthworms now on St. Paul campus. We've only found them in the city so far, not in forests. In Minneapolis, they ate someone's garden, and I went to look at it, and that turned out to be a Minthus agrestis, which is that long and that fat, and if you touch it, it can jump a couple of feet. So, and it had eaten the roots, had eaten all the roots in somebody's garden, because at certain times of the year, they swarm all into one area. So Asian earthworms are a big threat. Right now they're contained in cities. They are not out in the environment, and I suggest we don't let them get out into our natural habitats.
Other questions? I'm creeped out.
I like the jumping earthworm. That's kind of, I've never heard of that.
Well, thank you very much.
I'm thinking about being up here in Duluth and looking at the Royal Forest going north. Do you have, and this thinking about the potential impact on the forest products industry for the state, with the Royal Forest basically being gone and completely changing the wood stocks that we have, do you have much interaction with, do you sense much concern, or are they planning for this, or what's your sense of how?
Yeah,
it's an extrapolation from your presentation.
Field foresters are certainly starting to think about climate change and doing things like seeing if oak is doing well in northern Minnesota, where it used to be very limited by the cold temperatures and things like that. Forest industry tends to have a shorter planning horizon of 5 or 10 years, so you know there's a few planning cycles before it's really going to hit them. But obviously, if you switch from boreal forest to savanna, it's going to be much harder to grow trees. You could still plant trees. You could plant Black Hills spruce, you could plant Austrian pine, you could plant hybrid poplar, but it would be a whole different system where you had to grow the trees like an agricultural crop, rather than using natural regeneration and natural forests as a product that can be sent to the mill.
Yeah.
I'm out of my league on this question as well, but what does it do for our state in terms of carbon flows when you change forest cover types?
Yeah, well, if the boreal forest in northern Minnesota dies, which I think is something that will happen, there will be a huge flux of carbon to the atmosphere, absolutely gigantic. And then when the savannas come in, they'll start to sequester that carbon, but it will take them a few centuries to get back to the level of carbon that was in the forest. So in other words, it'll cause a big pulse of carbon into the atmosphere at just the wrong time. We don't need it. You know, all the boreal forests of Canada are now a source of CO2 rather than a sink. It's because they're having more droughts and more fires and insect outbreaks, and lots of trees are dying and decomposing.
Other questions? If not, Dr. Frelick, thanks for sharing with us your tremendous knowledge.
You are welcome.
All right. that concludes our presenters. Thank you to each of you for taking the time to be here today. I'd like to move then directly to the public comment period and I see a portion of the agenda, and I have one request. Bill Mittelfeld?
Yeah,
Mittelfeld. Please. Mittelfeld. Welcome.
Thank you.
I think that mic will work right there. It'll record.
I failed retirement like you did.
Okay, yeah.
So I think I can embellish. I have a few handouts here, and do you want to stand up and walk around?
No, that's fine.
If you were my students, I'd say that the oxygen content.
Yeah, no worries. We're doing well.
You sure you don't want to stand up?
Yes, we're going to have to be on the way back
all
to
right,
the Twin Cities.
Very dramatic. Okay. So I'm Bill Mittelfeld. I'm an employee of the state. I'm a public servant. I've been a public servant my whole life. I have two relatives who fought the American Revolution, and I think we still hear an echo of that right here. So I appreciate your service. And in the past, CERTS, which is Clean Energy Resource Teams, has worked with the Department of Commerce, EPA, PCA, and a number of the other organizations represented here at the table. So thank you so much for your service and your vision. As I was listening to the comments, I was watching that crane out there, and I think your task is similar to that crane, only there's a committee up there trying to lift those 1,000-ton objects and place them in exactly the right location for your climate prevention plan or your climate accommodation plan. So let me tell you how my experience may be of value to you, because I think CERTS is a tool that you may want to use in the development of your plan. If you don't know anything about CERTS, it developed in original collaboration about 2002 with the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and the plan was basically how can we keep Minnesota's money and investments in Minnesota? And the big idea was to reduce that $13 million that we're exporting every year, and because that's a capital investment fund for our kids' future. So we work in 8 regions. I'm the regional coordinator for this region. I love the office at UMD, and I'm out of it most of the time. I am one coordinator in 9 counties, so I'm spread very thinly, okay? But I meet exciting people like yourself who are seeing the signs of change. And so if you believe James Hansen, we have about 10 years to change the direction. If you believe what Mr. McKibben is writing on 350, we have about a decade to change the direction of the super tanker. Now, it's my obligation as a citizen of Duluth, and I wanted to thank Senator Anderson for the leadership, and when the Lieutenant Governor was here, this next-gen legislation gave birth to CERTS, and that's why we've gone statewide, and we're working with communities, cities, schools, counties, and businesses to save that money and invest it again in Minnesota's local economy. So as a citizen of Duluth, I'm obligated to invite you to enjoy Duluth and its new horizon. As you know, we are a port, you see it, a port of possibility. And we invite you to come here and be changed by our people, our community, and our heritage. We've brought some of the heritage for you there, you've seen some of it here, and you've watched it on the screen. We're a community about collaboration because that's actually what built this community in this relatively challenging environment. Okay? In June 2000, my daughter and I left from that beach over there and paddled to New York City that way, gathering stories. I was on a national foundation and we were encouraged to give something. The next millennium is 99, became 2000. So by the time we reached New York City, we had 22 stories. It was about 1,650 miles, and my daughter, by the way, is a woman of steel, like some of you. And the purpose was, what makes America so successful at the grassroots? So by the time we had gathered our 22 stories, we got to be on the Regis show, made the New York paper. Big idea for your benefit and for your mission as a large crane lifting these objects with a committee up there on the top is, what makes America so hopeful at the grassroots? Because if you kill the hope, and how many of you got a little anxious about the Asian worms? How many of you worried about the area of concern? We share these concerns, and we're motivated partly by our anxiety, but what unifies us and gives us power is hope. So what does CERTS have to offer for you? Well, is Jody Slick here today? Jody Slick is one of our outstanding citizen leaders here. She is the CEO of something called Equilibrium 3, right down the road. And she's been recognized by the White House for her leadership with the Environmental Quality Board, not the EPA, the EPA. And she's been recognized after the White House last summer. But one of the things that she did with this Georgetown University Energy Prize that the mayor has described to you, I think, and that's one of the handouts that I have. We're very just delighted we passed the August cut. So now there are 52 communities involved, and we are the only one in Minnesota. So we're going to do some work for you. But then if you believe this, there's got to be some outcomes that we can measure. We're going to put together a unique team for the state of Minnesota that's going to involve the faith community here. There's a group called the Arrowhead Network of the Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light Group. Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light Group is over 200 congregations and faith teams throughout the state who are really motivated by climate change. So these are more than 200 allies who are already moving in your direction, waiting for your plan, waiting to help you. We're also using an established program called YES, which is Youth Energy Summit. It's been in southern Minnesota since 2007 now. Those energy projects established by those kids are saving their schools and communities thousands of dollars. They're also helping the struggle to reduce climate impacts. So we're going to involve the business community. We've already involved UMD. You've heard some of the expertise here, but there's additional staff who are very interested in helping the city organize this team. And it's basically the mayor's vision that Duluth is going to finish in the top group. In December, they'll be the last cut. Then 10 teams will be competing for 2 years to reduce energy emissions, save money, and recycle that capital investing in Minnesota's future. So I think we're going to develop a template for you, and we hope to have something to share. Let's say that will be the end of 2016, that then could benefit from your plan. I don't know where your plan will be in 2016, but we might have an operating entity that you could point to, and you might have a plan that we could point to and say, this is the way of Minnesota's future. Because I conclude with the point that hope is Minnesota's most renewable resource. And because we all share these anxieties, Asian worms, et cetera, failing, retirement, that we need to hope together. And that's really your mission, and that's sort of like your training challenge. I appreciate your service, and CERTS, my whole team, we're 20 people, budget's $1.5 million. We would like to help you do this, and I appreciate those of you who passed that legislation a while back, because Minnesota, I think, is the only state in the union with a program like this that's actually grounded in working in communities in Flat Region, so you don't do it from the top down, you do it face-to-face. Thanks for your time, I appreciate your effort.
All set.
Thanks. Any questions for Bill before you run away? Seeing none, thank you again.
Thank you.
Throw it open to the board. I think we've had a really interesting afternoon, wonderful information, learned a lot, take away a lot. Comments? John?
Mr. Chair, I agree that it's really useful to get out and see another part of the state up close with people that live and work and operate business. I'd like to see more of the state this way. I think as a group it's helpful because we hear about issues in our own language and our own work lives separate from everything else. And this today was really helpful, I think, in some degree of integration. So maybe a board member from Moorhead could have us over and see the Red River Valley and some of the work that's going on over there.
Yeah, Commissioner Landwin was there last week. It was wonderful, wasn't it?
It was ambushed by the media. There's not to be prepared for that.
For the Moorhead diversion, we have some other issues with parks. Oh, yeah. That would be interesting for everybody
to hear. Yeah. I agree. How about from the annex over there? The jury box.
The kids table.
Well, we have to have some fun.
Mr. Chair.
Kate?
I just want to reiterate that I'm really excited about this report, and I'm really excited about the work that EQB is doing in collaboration with many great people around the state. CERTS is just one of many examples. I think the presentations we have at the lake, which I learned a lot, and about the forest, and I think every time I hear Dr. Freilich speak, I learn something new about our forest. The state is changing in ways that we need to adapt to and need to lessen our impact on as much as we can, and I think that I'm really glad the board is being better educated, and then the citizens are going to be better educated about those impacts and some of the steps we can take. And I'm looking forward to the next step, sort of jumping off from this report, and then I think the serious impacts the state's having and the questions we need to be asking, both how do we change our policy so we can adapt, you know, hearing about FEMA not allowing to rebuild in a more, or at least not helping rebuild in a more resilient fashion, and do we need some state policy change to help facilitate that, to the great grassroots work of CERT. So I'm really excited about today's meeting, and I'm looking forward to helping as we move forward.
Agreed. Tom?
Mr. Just a thought of when I hear some of this discussion about, you know, what the results of climate change are, it's hard to not get depressed because, you know, they aren't. I mean, I like the place I live right now. I don't want to be different. I'm going to go to Ely on Friday, and I want always to have the boreal forest up there. I think the thing that strikes me is, you know, what we're hearing. I think once upon a time when we heard projections about what the future is going to look like, it was with the notion that, well, if we change our behavior today, that won't come. The reality is that it's going to come. Even if we change our behavior 100% today, this is like turning a slow-moving bullet. This is going to take 100 years to work through the system. So I think one of the things, you know, we have to continue to talk about how to reduce our footprint, our greenhouse gas emissions, because we would like it to get to a more normal state. But I think the other thing we have to face is it will be different 7 years from now. What do we need to start doing now to adapt for that, you know, both from the natural environment, you know, Dr. Frelick's work on tree composition, that will have an impact on the forest products industry. We need to think about what we can do either with reforestation or shifting our basket for different uses, as well as infrastructure. You know, the flood of 2012 will likely recur within 50 years. And so how do we do our infrastructure system such that we don't, you know, just follow the FEMA model and rebuild what we have, but that are more adaptive to that. So I think it becomes really incumbent for us as agencies to start thinking about what do we do as an executive branch to start positioning ourselves for what the future is going to bring, and continue to do what we can to reduce our emissions, but recognize that under our best scenarios, we are going to the places that have been described today.
And I think this, you know, my compliments to the staff, Megan, Anna, Kate, Caroline, Heather, for your great work, Bob, Ellen, Anna, all of you, that worked so hard to put this great document together. And it is a starting point, I think, for all of us, and just my hats off to the work that you did, and thank you. Ed?
Yeah, I sort of listed all of these things in terms of, you know, what impact it's going to have on the people. And you can just see the health implications of all these changes. But it also struck me that as we have this changing environment, our population is going to change. And I think at some point I'd love to have our state demographer think about how climate change is actually going to change people. Not change people who are here, but to change the kind of people who are here. We may get, you know, a lot of mobility, may have different kinds of populations of people coming to Minnesota, living in Minnesota. I think that has some major implications. Probably our state environment, but starting looking at climate change and in terms of demographic changes in our population.
Ryan, are you sick today?
No, I'm just listening today. Not true. I think I'm like Commissioner Lambert, kind of depressed.
Yeah. And that is a really big worm up here. Well, Kristen?
I'm excited about the new website and the opportunity that creates to share some of what we've learned. I mean, it's really a lot to try to digest. And, you know, I love to see, you know, presentations like that up so that it's easy to share with people as we all try to grasp, you know, what's happening. And I think at a really simple level question, I find that I keep asking as I'm encountering more and more of this material is, given these really huge and rapid changes, you know, what can we ask of ourselves, and what can we realistically ask of one another in the challenge that Commissioner and I heard articulated.
And the good news is that folks like Bill are talking about the work that public education, public schools are doing I noticed Apollo High School in St. Cloud doing some great work. Lindstrom, Minnesota, the students up there are doing some great work, and so that's encouraging. With that, I believe we are at the point where we can, there is a motion to adjourn. Is there a second? There is. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All the same sign. The motion carries. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.